Now, for those of you who don't know me, my name is Sarah Joseph. I'm the director of the Caston Centre, and we're very pleased to present tonight's event along with Human Rights Watch. But, remiss of me, I would like to start by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land, the Kulin, the peoples of the Kulin Nations, on whose land we are gathered here today to pay my respects to elders past and present. So tonight's event is on human rights in Uganda, entitled Intimidation and Repression in Uganda. As has become custom, the Caston Centre will be tweeting this event, and if you are interested in following along, the hashtag is hashtag CCUganda. So I should inform both of our speakers, people aren't just sitting there texting, they're tweeting. Now, we have two excellent speakers tonight. I will introduce them in turn. So our first speaker is Maria Burnett, who is Senior Researcher in the Africa Division of Human Rights Watch, and she currently covers Uganda, emerging human rights issues in Central Africa, and she supervises work on Somalia and Kenya. She has worked with Human Rights Watch since 2005, first as the Burundi Researcher in the Bujumbura Field Office. I hope I pronounced that correctly. Sorry, Bujumbura. And Maria has also worked on a range of human rights issues, including child soldiers, torture and killings by intelligence and counter-terrorism agents, abuses by the Lord's Resistance Army, and justice reform in Central and East Africa. Will you please welcome Maria Burnett?
Thank you so much, and thank you for coming tonight. Maybe just to explain, I think as Nicholas and I envision things, I was going to talk a bit about the run-up to this most recent set of elections. Uganda just had elections in February, and Nicholas was going to talk a bit about the aftermath of those elections. It's been quite an exciting few months in Uganda. But obviously we're happy to take questions on a whole range of issues, and I'll mention on the Human Rights Watch side of things, in my time covering Uganda at Human Rights Watch, I've worked on a really broad range of topics. Everything from sort of business and human rights, security sector reform, criminal justice, juveniles, just a really broad range. So I'm happy to talk about any of that if there's particular interest in the room. So as I'm sure many of you know, President Museveni has been in power now since 1986. In 2005, the constitution was amended to eliminate term limits, which paved the way for him to be able to run several more times, and he has just won the most recent elections in February of this year. In the run-up to those elections, we had many of the concerns that we have had over the last decade, I would say, in Uganda. So we've put out reports, for example, looking at threats to civil society operating space. It's quite a complicated issue, and it's one that affects many different countries in East Africa. In the Uganda context, we've been particularly concerned about NGOs that are working on issues that touch on the finances. So particularly, for example, groups looking at land, evictions, oil sector transparency and money transparency and the way government operates. And then in terms of human rights organizations, we've had a lot of concerns about the government's treatment of LGBTI Ugandans and groups that are working to protect the rights of LGBTI people in Uganda. Over the years, as we've documented different threats to civil society operating space, I feel like what we've seen is the government more or less harden its position, and we've just seen them write and pass a new law. I hope Nicholas will talk about it more, but the troubling aspect of that was that in the midst of the run-up to these elections, the government presented a law which basically created a series of new crimes for NGO workers, including making a punishable 3-year offense for the violating the dignity of the people of Uganda, which we felt was, you know, obviously a really broad and vague term that left the interpretation of the dignity of all Ugandans just open to the government alone, and therefore anything that the government deemed to be a problem could potentially be captured in that phrase. We've had long-standing concerns about media freedom and freedom of expression in Uganda, particularly for rural-based journalists. There's a real, I think we see a real dichotomy almost in Uganda in the print speaking, in the print English-speaking media, the newspapers that publish in Kampala. You can certainly criticize government, you can point out problems in governance. But when you get into the more rural areas, when you get into local languages, there we see, I think, a different landscape. The journalists are much more vulnerable to intimidation and threats. There's a quite heavy presence of the ruling party, and the intelligence services are quite dominant. And it's always important to note that most radio stations in Uganda are owned either by the government or by ruling party parliamentarians, which means they obviously have a vested business interest in ensuring that, generally speaking, the discussions on radio support the government line. So over the years, we've documented various kinds of threats. For example, in the run-up to the 2011 elections, we had concerns such as, you know, you try to host a talk show on a radio station. This is upcountry. You invite different representatives of the different political groups. The ruling party chooses not to send someone. It leaves the program manager in a real bind, because if they host the program, they fear that intelligence will come and shut down the program, and we had many instances of that. We had similar concerns in the run-up to these elections, where some of the stations that hosted opposition political parties or representatives were temporarily pulled off air. So these kinds of threats and intimidation to free expression have played a really troubling role. At the same time, I think we've seen a real change when it comes to social media. It certainly allowed different people to participate and express themselves and to expand the space for free expression. And in turn, we saw the government try to shut down social media during the election. They tried to ban all access to social media during the past election for 5 days. It didn't really work. People wildly downloaded VPNs and went around the blockades that had been put up. But it was an interesting example of efforts to constrain the space for free expression in Uganda. And the last thing I'll mention as far as our concerns, long-standing concerns about the conduct of security forces, particularly in the space for public assemblies. We've had several instances where there have been anti-government demonstrations over the last 7-8 years, and each time there have been killings of either protesters or largely bystanders to protest. So we saw the military and the police be deployed very, very quickly, and then immediately the use of live gunfire in situations where there was no lethal threat posed to the security forces. And we are constantly reminding the security forces that they have to operate within the UN principles, which means that they can only use lethal force when it is required to protect human life. And for many years now, we've been pushing the government to hold investigations into the killings that occurred in 2009 and in 2011. It's actually the 5-year anniversary of a bunch of killings that happened in April 2011, just this week. In fact, tomorrow is the anniversary of the killing of a 2-year-old child in Masaka that occurred during anti-government demonstrations. And still, there's been no investigation, and no one's been held accountable for her death. In the face of the criticism that Human Rights Watch and other NGOs brought to the table about the conduct of security forces during assemblies, what we've seen is the government become one of the largest consumers of tear gas in all of Africa. So they've really, really escalated the desire to have non-lethal means. Now, that's certainly a good thing in the sense that we hope that that would mean that they would reduce their use of live gunfire. But we've also had a lot of concerns about the way tear gas has been used and the context in which it's been used. For example, in September of last year, we documented many different instances in which tear gas was used basically to just keep people away from hearing the views of the opposition. So it was used before anybody had demonstrated or done anything. It was an opposition meeting, and the police argued that because the meeting was in and of itself done without police permission, that was a basis to tear gas the attendees who were there. They ended up tear gassing school children. They lobbed these canisters into some primary schools. We also documented instances in which the tear gas was used as a weapon that is fired directly at journalists to stop them from being able to record or broadcast live events as they were unfolding. You know, advocacy with the government in Uganda is very challenging. As I said, they've been in power for a very long time. I think President Museveni's sort of inner circle of advisors is decreasing over the years. We do meet with the government very, very regularly, but it is a challenge when it's the same people in power for so many years. I think that what I've seen is an amazing capacity of the government of Uganda to exhaust the diplomatic community and even some NGOs in their dialogue. And I think it can be quite frustrating that even when there are advocacy wins, for example, Nicholas can talk about this as well, but finally after many years, Uganda passed a law criminalizing torture. It would seem like a basic thing, but for many years, there was no law in the books that criminalized torture, and we had many, many, many cases of torture going on in the country. But despite that law being passed, we still haven't seen a single prosecution take place because police and prosecutors don't work together to actually bring those cases before courts of law. So, I would say over my time of working on Uganda, we have small successes as far as fighting to protect human rights, but the big picture remains quite problematic. And certainly, it's no secret that part of what makes advocacy to protect human rights in Uganda difficult is because the government of Uganda is a really important ally to some Western governments in the fight against terrorism in East Africa. I'm sure as many of you know, the Ugandans are the sort of lead boots on the ground in the African Union's mission in Somalia. Many of us would argue that Uganda has its own reasons for being there, that it has its own concerns for the presence of Al-Shabaab in East Africa. But I think there is a concern, certainly in the United States, that the Ugandans are sort of, to some extent, seen as a proxy Western force. And so therefore, they have not always wanted to scrutinize the actions of the security forces domestically. There's also a pretty significant and interesting operation going against the Lord's Resistance Army. As I'm sure many of you know, there has been a long conflict between the Lord's Resistance Army and the Museveni government in northern Uganda. Over the years, it's been displaced to Congo and now to Central African Republic. And a few years ago, President Obama signed a law which said that the United States was going to give military advisors to assist in the fight against the Lord's Resistance Army. There were a lot of theories about how that mission would come together. It was supposed to be a sort of regional task force under an AU umbrella. In reality, it's really come to mean that there is a deployment of Ugandan soldiers in Central African Republic. Meanwhile, Kony himself has moved into what is the jurisdiction of Sudan, which means it's actually beyond the reach of both the U.S. military advisors and the Ugandan military. So it remains a very difficult operation. I think there's, all good reason to try to protect people in that region from the Lord's Resistance Army, but there are also a lot of other warring parties in that region. And I'm very concerned that that mission is very, very expensive with not necessarily as much proactive effort to improve the security vacuum in that region, which remains, the people there remain very, very vulnerable to attacks by all different groups. So our push has certainly been to look at Uganda's key donors and to say, you need to be speaking truth here about the abuses that are going on the electoral season. And this is what I hope Nicholas will talk about, is some of the abuses that went on after the election. But this is a precarious time, I think, as we look into the next 5 years with the government taking the new parliament taking office in June, I guess it will be. Where is this going to go, and how is the political opposition finding a space to be, in opposition role? Can they bring issues to the table? Can parliament function as a check on the power of the executive? Can Uganda's strong constitution, there are many good human rights principles in Uganda's constitution that unfortunately don't really end up living a full life in the reality of the rights of Ugandans. So I'll stop there. I'm happy to take questions, and I'm grateful for all the interest in Uganda this evening. Thank you.
We will have time for questions at the end, but it gives me great pleasure to introduce our second speaker tonight, Nicholas Opiel, who is a leading human rights lawyer from Uganda and the founder of the human rights organisation Chapter 4 Uganda, and he has worked tirelessly since 2005 to defend civil liberties in Uganda, often for free and often and on behalf of society's most vulnerable and marginalised. Nicholas has worked on a broad range of critical human rights issues in Uganda, and he was a key leader in drafting and advocating for Uganda's law criminalising torture, which we just heard about. He has successfully argued in many high-level constitutional challenges, including one to the notorious Anti-Homosexuality Act of 2013, which we've heard quite a lot about in this country, which was declared null and void in August 2014. Please welcome the press.
A very good evening to all of you. I am delighted to be here today. Long distance traveling here, but I made it. It's my first time in Australia, so I'm delighted to be here. I'm even happier to see fellow Ugandans in the audience. Really, it gives me a lot of pleasure to meet my countrymen and women. And thank you for taking good care of them. They look great. I can tell from the looks on their faces they are happy. Ugandans never hide their joy wherever they go. So I'm happy to join you this evening to share with you my thoughts on what's happening in Uganda post-election. But before I do that, let me just highlight two important things. The first one is that, as Maria mentioned, Uganda is a key partner in the global fight against terror. Uganda was the first country on the continent to deploy its troops on the ground in Somalia in the fight against Al-Shabaab. For a long time, it was the only country in Somalia fighting the Al-Shabaab. At the cost of our fellow countrymen who fell in battle in keeping the region safe. So Uganda is a very key partner in the fight against terror in the world and, of course, in the African region. I think besides the US, we perhaps are the only other country that deployed the most outside of our borders. We are deployed in four different countries. Uganda is deployed in Somalia. Uganda has been deployed in South Sudan now for a long time to try and resolve the conflict and keep the peace in South Sudan. Uganda is deployed in the DRC Congo fighting two rebel groups, the Lord's Resistance Army and the Allied Democratic Forces. And as Maria said now, they have spilled over into the Central African Republic. So we have an important role to play in the region. Our president is perhaps the only surviving head of state who is a signatory to the East African Community Treaty. All the rest that signed with him have since left. He's still around. He's been in power for a long time. Secondly, Uganda is a fairly peaceful country now. At least within our borders, there's no civil war. The LRA were driven out of Uganda. There are sometimes attacks from the western part of Uganda by rebel groups in the DRC. But Uganda is a fairly peaceful country. Even northern Uganda, where I grew up as a young child, in ITP camps, as a night commuter in northern Uganda, night commuters were young kids who used to walk several miles to avoid abduction to sleep in open public spaces. So Uganda is now a fairly peaceful country. We have elections. You can argue about the quality of the elections, but every 5 years we now have elections that are multi-party in nature, so there are many people who contest for power. The last election just ended in February of this year. Now, the elections notwithstanding, there are serious concerns about the democratic progress of Uganda, about the quality of our elections, about respect for fundamental rights and freedoms. So the progress notwithstanding, there are still serious concerns that I think I want to share with you this evening. And I'll start with the last election. Uganda went to the polls on February 18th. That election was a very hotly contested election because the president's personal doctor, who broke ranks with him 15 years ago, was contesting for the fourth time against him. And his personal friend for over 40 years, who was a prime minister, also broke ranks with him and contested the election. So the election was very fiercely contested. That there was widespread hopes amongst Ugandans that for the very first time, President Museveni was staring at defeat in the face. That there was a real chance for a peaceful transfer of power from one individual to another. Because ever since our country gained independence in 1962, we have never seen a peaceful transfer of power. All transfers of power have been by means of a coup, oftentimes at the cost of human lives. But that hope was dashed, of course, because the president won the election. The election was, as was the case the last two times, challenged in the Supreme Court. the Supreme Court delivered a decision that many still dispute in Uganda, confirming the election of the president. Now, during the election, there were serious concerns that were raised. The first, really, as Ugandans went to the polls, the president, or the government for that matter, switched off social media and mobile money platforms. Now, mobile money doesn't make sense to people in Australia, right? You have plastic cards. But in Uganda, the vast majority of the rural population depend on mobile money, mobile phones to send money to people. So if my father in the village 4.5 hours north of Kampala is sick and wants money for, to buy medicine, he would simply call me and I would get on my phone and send him money and he would go and see a doctor. So mobile money is a very powerful means of transaction. So on the opening of ballots on the 18th of February, mobile money platforms were switched off. That meant that opposition leaders who were supposed to send money to their agents who were supposed to go and sit at the polling stations to observe elections were unable to do so. As a result, many of their agents couldn't get money, so they had to leave their stations to go and look for food, and the process miss out on the chance to actually observe the elections in their local areas. In many cases, many of them just didn't turn up because they didn't have money to have transport to go to the polling station. The second one was social media. Now, you have to understand the role social media plays in Uganda as a tool for mobilization to appreciate just how absurd it was that social media was switched off. First of all, social media is the main form of activism now. During the elections, so many candidates were able to reach so many people because of social media. Of course, social media was also used for other propaganda purposes, but on the whole, it was a very important tool for mobilization. So a citizen who was seeing human rights violation could simply use his or her phone, take a picture and tweet it, or send it by WhatsApp, or send it on Facebook, and that would create real outrage across the country. So what they did on election day was to switch off social media, thereby denying people the chance to report live what was happening, denying very many people a chance to even report results of the elections as they were counted at polling stations. So this was deliberate. Even though many Ugandans found their way around it by downloading VPN, I think they helped us to learn about VPN. Many people went online and downloaded VPN, but even then that was still disruptive and wasn't enough to restore enough access. The second important thing that happened on election day was that one of the candidates was arrested. Now you imagine a candidate in elections being arrested on polling day. And the reason was simple. He wasn't even demonstrating. He wasn't causing any problem. He suspected that a house in an upscale part of town was being used to stuff ballot papers. So he simply stormed the house and asked that the house be open for him to have a look. And for doing that, he was arrested and driven back to his house and told to stay in his house. While the people who were stuffing ballots in that house were jumping over the fence in full view of TV cameras and throwing ballot boxes across the fence, the opposition leader was being arrested and told to go back home and stay indoors and not complain about it. That marked the beginning of a house arrest for that opposition leader, who was never allowed to leave his house for 45 days. For no reason, there was no charge in court. There was no case against him, but he just couldn't leave his house. He couldn't even see his lawyers to be able to challenge the elections in court. He couldn't go to the party offices because even the party offices were raided because it was alleged that he was compiling his own results. So even if the elections, these serious concerns in many respects really affect the quality of our elections. The president might have won, he might have gotten legal victory in the Supreme Court, but there's a whole question about the legitimacy of his election. And that will make the next 5 years a difficult time for Uganda. The second thing really about the post-election is the continued restriction. Even if after 45 days, the opposition leader is now allowed to leave his house, he leaves his house under police escort. He's being followed wherever he goes. He's unable to do anything without interference by the state. Just yesterday, somebody was informing me back home. He was going to attend to a court hearing west of the country. He was followed throughout the country. And as I speak now, he's being holed up in a hotel, and he can't leave the hotel in that district because they just blocked his way. No reason given. Now, each time he attempts to come back, he's a very popular guy. He's called Dr. Kizza Besigye. Each time he attempts to come to town, he attracts a large crowd, and people come to show support. The police got tired of that. Now, what they have done is to deploy masked men in black T-shirts with huge sticks to literally beat people on the streets. It sounds like a gang, right? But that's exactly what the state has done. In full view of cameras, under the command of the police, masked, armed men with sticks are beating up civilians on the streets for nothing else but just showing up on the streets and waving the V sign. This is the sign of the leader. And there are no investigations, there's no arrest, there are no prosecutions. Now, you have to understand the role of men in black T-shirts in Uganda in the past. They have raided the High Court in the past and abducted suspects from the judges' chambers when the judge was hearing a case. They have held demonstrations against judges for giving decisions against the state. So these black men are very notorious in our country. In the past, they were called black mambas because the ones that stormed the courthouse were called black mambas. So there's serious concerns about the dignity and assault of people and being able to demonstrate freely in Uganda. The third thing is really about the increasing intolerance towards civil society. Because prior to the election, civil society held a countrywide mobilization, really asking Ugandans what sort of reforms they wanted to see before the election. That ended up in what was called a Citizens Compact, which was a set of reforms that was agreed by the vast majority of people in Uganda. And they put these demands to the state and asked the state to amend the electoral laws to ensure a free and fair election. The state ignored that, but instead accused civil society organizations for having a political agenda in the country. And that has seen an increasing intolerance towards civil society organizations, particularly those who are working around the areas of governance and human rights. I mean, if you're distributing food and digging a borehole, they have no problem with you, okay? Because you are essentially subsidizing state inefficiency. But the ones that are asking for accountability, respect for human rights, are faced increasing intimidation by government officials. Recently, a new law was passed called the NGO Act, the Non-Governmental Organizations Act. The law is simply really a permit regime so that anybody who wants to go and do work for charity has to get, one, a permission from the state to do so, even if you're registered. And the condition for grant of that permission are very, very stringent. Namely, first, that you must have what they call a memorandum of understanding with local communities and local district officials. Now, that's nearly impossible. Take, for example, if you're a national organization, how many communities are you going to get MOUs from? They also can deny you a permit on allegations of what they call working against the dignity of the people of Uganda. Very broad terms. It's unknown what it is meant by working against the dignity of the people of Uganda. For example, would using a picture of a starving child to ask for food aid amount to acting against the dignity of the people of Uganda? Your guess is as good as mine. But that is also viewed as really a provision that's targeting minority groups, particularly those working with sex workers and sexual minorities, the LGBTI community. Because for a very long time, there have been attempts to restrict their activities in Uganda. LGBTI organizations cannot register legally as legal entities in Uganda. And with this law, even their informal ways of organization will become criminal, because organize around such things, you must register and get a permit. So this law, and in particular this provision on against the dignity of people of Uganda, is just meant to target such groups that are very unpopular in Uganda. The fourth thing, again, is just about sexual minorities. Maria told you about the anti-gay law which was declared null and void by the country's constitutional court in 2014. even though that was a good case, in my view, it didn't resolve a bigger problem, which is the question of the attitudes of Ugandans towards sexual minorities, towards sex workers, and other minority groups. Because up until now, sexual minorities face intense discrimination in access to social services. It's difficult for them to go to a hospital to get treatment without being targeted. Just before I came here, 4 days ago, a gay man was beaten on the street by a mob and had his jaws dislocated. He's trying to fix back his jaws. Many people are being expelled by their families because they simply have a different sexual orientation. There's widespread disapproval of LGBTI communities in Uganda. There's a 1950 legislation that still remains on our law books that is being used to prosecute people on the basis of their sexual orientation. That law is really a law left by the British in 1950, which essentially outlawed what is called having carnal knowledge against the order of nature. I have no idea what that is. What is having carnal knowledge against the nature? I mean, the order of nature. But that is being used to prosecute gay people in Uganda. And for the very first time in our country's history, last year there were two convictions under that law. And these people face a very rough time in Uganda. We do provide them legal services, but it's just a drop in the ocean in terms of what is required. The last one that I want to speak about really is what I see as a pattern now, the attack on women. The particular onslaught on women involved in activism. Now, it sounds, perhaps it's random, but ladies who are taking part in electoral politics are increasingly becoming a target by the police force to physical abuse, to abuse of their integrity. Many people have been undressed in public, and people tend to have more outrage if you undress a woman in public than when you do a man. They don't do undress men anyway. So they target women so that they discourage women from taking part in active elective politics by doing things like undressing them in public, squeezing hard their breasts, touching their private parts, and really handling opposition women in a way that is very degrading. This appears to be a pattern that is now emerging. And then lastly, I just want to leave some time for questions, is the onslaught on the media. Because in Uganda, the most popular means of information sharing, besides social media, are FM stations that are all over the country. If you want to get to the population, you just go to a local language FM station and people just listen. You find a village woman in a very small village market with a small radio listening. And whatever they listen on radio is gospel truth. So there's a move to restrict use and access to the media for people who are seen to be critical of government or who are dissenters. Media owners are being put under immense pressure not to host people who hold different views. Radio talk show hosts appear in many shows in Uganda, are increasingly becoming resentful of hosting people who are seen as critical of the state. And just to conclude on the LGBTI issue, again, on the weekend before I came, the Speaker of the National Assembly, she's involved in a very fierce campaign to retain her seat as Speaker, appeared on a weekend talk show, a very popular one called The Capital Gang, on a radio station in Kampala, and promised that if she's elected Speaker, she will reintroduce the law against homosexuality. Now, the Speaker has done that before, but really the point that I wanted to make is that sexual minorities are used as a political scapegoat for people in Uganda who want election, because they know that it is very popular with many people across the country. So they evoke that as a sense of seeking sympathy to win elections. And this Speaker of the National Assembly has been some kind of a queen at doing that. And she's again... bringing up this kind of discussion because she's coming up against an election in May when her term as a speaker expires. But I'll leave the rest for questions. There's so much I can talk about youth and the role of the youth in Uganda. Uganda is 75% of this population is below the age of 35, so they have their own set of challenges. But I'll leave it for Q&A. So thank you for listening to me.
we might throw it open. I think it's a bit silly for me to stand and you guys to sit, so I'll sit too. But I might field the questions from here. So have we got, we've got about 20 minutes worth of questions, so we've got a question in the middle there. And could people remember to speak up? Because
Hi, I'm Suzanne Mission, and I worked in Uganda last year in Kampala with London. And I wanted to say, Nicholas and Ria, thank you very much for your talk. What I didn't really understand before I went to Uganda was that having a benevolent dictator like Museveni can be better than other situations in Africa. Like, I kind of thought it was democracy or nothing. But I'd like to know from Nicholas, how do you think Uganda can move towards real democracy?
Should we take several questions? Or?
Okay,
we've got one in the front.
Can Nicholas, welcome to Australia. My name is Davis.
Thank you, Davis.
I've got a question for you in regards to the role of the courts in oppression. A couple of times there are cases in court that appear to have gone the wrong way, and based on the previous court rulings on elections, court made some recommendation in terms of the obicta. How come they've never followed them up? I would think they would have strengthened democracy if they followed them up with government.
And we've got one down the right there.
Thank you. My name is Ilusi. My question is in relation to Uganda and the rest of East Africa. Last year, there was a coup in Burundi where more than 250,000 Burundian people in the country, Rwanda. And since the coup, diplomatic relations between Rwanda and the Burundi is going down at the moment. My question is about African Union. Why African Union appointed Mr. Museveni to become the mediator of the political conflict in Burundi while he's seeking himself more than the third term. While the media paid more attention on Burundian issues, when Uganda, Rwanda have been presidents have been ruling the country more than two decades or three, there's no political attention on international basis. Finally, it's when I was working last year, I went overseas for an engineer of the United Nations for an intern, and was involved in the section of empowering refugees. My question about regards Kenya is about 2007 violence, when there was an election where the opposition contested the election, saying that he won the election, similar to Uganda, what is happening at the moment. Now, the International Criminal Court took the matter, and both president and first president, the case have been acquitted. My question about Kenya is the Human Rights Watch or international community paying attention on witnesses who gave evidence in The Hague? If you know, why they were involved? Because in Africa, as much as I'm concerned, who has the money is the one who has the power. It's not about what happened. It's about the poor to protect the rich. Is the Human Rights Watch in Africa, in general, in particular, Burundi, Rwanda, Kenya and Uganda, aware? Because I've read your experiences. In 2005, when President Burundi was appointed,
I think we should probably move on. Okay. I'm sure you both got something to say, so it's probably best if one by one, because it'd be easier to project the voice.
Yeah. Well, thank you for your great questions. I'll leave the hard ones for Maria. She after all works for Human Rights Watch, right? Let me start with Susan. You said Uganda is a benevolent dictator. How can Uganda be assisted to move forward towards a fully fledged democracy. I think first we've got to underscore that Uganda has come a long way. From the dictatorial and murderous regime of Idi Amin to a hugely difficult regime of Milton Obote. So Uganda has made some progress. And I think that in measuring Uganda's democratic credentials, we've got to acknowledge that as a starting point. But it's also true that Uganda still falls far short of being a fully fledged democracy that is inclusive, that is a progressive democracy that respects the rule of law, where everybody is equal before the law. That's a fact. How can Uganda be assisted to become a fully fledged democracy? I think that first and foremost, you've got to underscore the point that it is Ugandans who must take the first responsibility for making their country a democratic country. It is not going to be given to us by some foreign power. Even if they assist us, it is not their primary responsibility. So the duty of making Uganda a democratic state lies with Ugandans. And therefore, civic awareness in Uganda then becomes a very important point to underscore. That the ordinary people in Uganda need to appreciate, for example, that the breakdown in roads and services across the country, it's not just because of corruption, not just because of the theft in central government, but because it's a governance problem. And each time I speak to people in my village, which is very far from Kampala, is that I don't simply tell them you have a right to demonstrate. I think we have an obligation to connect human rights in the abstract to the daily lives of Ugandans who really have frustrations. 16 women die every day giving birth across the country. You've got to make a connection between that and governance and begin to ask people to demand accountability of their leaders. Because even if a leader has control of all the power, all the guns, all the money, I think that people collectively are still more powerful. I use the analogy of a bicycle tire. People in government are like bicycle tires. They respond to pressure if you keep pumping them. So we've got to incite Ugandans to keep pumping that tire until it responds to pressure. And only Ugandans can do that. But the international community has a role as well, because Uganda depends on aid, largely depends on aid. A lot of our development budget is still funded by loans from the World Bank, grants and donations from other countries. So those countries have a responsibility to see that their investment is made in a more democratic state. And I think that they have not just a moral but a legal responsibility to ensure that Uganda and the Ugandan state invests in its people and respects fundamental rights and freedoms. So I think that Australia, as I speak right now, the Australian Special Envoy for Human Rights, the Honorable Philip Rudo, is in Kampala listening to people in Uganda. I hope that beyond just listening, they can take a proactive step to ensure that Uganda, as a member of the international community, is made to conform to the international standards that we all aspire for. David, you talk about the courts. I practice law in Uganda, and I understand the frustration of Ugandans in the court system. The judiciary in Uganda is going through a makeover because the old conservative and sometimes progressive judges have either died or retired. And so it's being replenished at all levels, really. The Supreme Court, the Court of Appeal, the High Court. So the courts are getting new judges. The general feeling in Uganda is that the judges who are being appointed are what we call cadre judges. These are people who have either lost elections, failed politicians. They might qualify as lawyers and judges, but in fact their primary preoccupation is not critical thinking about how to apply the law, but applying politics to the law. The Supreme Court now has nearly half of its members are former government ministers who lost elections, who are seen as appointed to the bench to keep them comfortable, you know. So there's a serious doubt about the independence of the courts in Uganda. And indeed, as you said, David, in the last two presidential elections, the court made serious recommendations. It wasn't a court judgment. In law, we say there were decisions obiter. Those were decisions made as a by-the-way recommendations. But a decision, a recommendation from the Supreme Court in any country should be taken seriously. But in Uganda, that's not the case. All of the court's recommendations in the past two presidential election petitions at the Supreme Court were ignored by the state. In fact, this time, the Supreme Court again made the same recommendations in their decision. The court is viewed as a lamenting court, so the court is also lamenting like any other ordinary Ugandan. Judges just saying, please, please do this. You've turned our judges into lamenting justices of the Supreme Court. Judges don't lament, they issue orders. But the court has felt, has felt shy of issuing binding orders on the state. There's a lack of judicial activism. For example, in this last Supreme Court hearing, I led the team by civil society organizations who applied to be admitted by the court as friends of the court, or what they call amicus, before the court. The court rejected our application for amicus. But in doing so, the court was seized with the argument that we were going to make, that court has a duty to give government even timelines to say, we have made these recommendations, please come back to us in 6 months and update us on progress. And the court felt very shy of doing that, and as such, we have those recommendations that are still pending. Because all election observation reports since 2001, whether local or international, recommended reforms of electoral systems, but they have all been ignored. Innocent, I'll leave a large part of your question to Maria because she worked in Bujumbura and she has a better knowledge of Bujumbura than I do. But just to answer that, two things. First, President Museveni, as I said, is the only surviving signatory to the East African Treaty. So he's seen as a regional statesman. But also historically, President Museveni played a key role with Thabo Mbeki of South Africa in the Arusha Accord that brought peace to Burundi. So he was a natural choice, but a choice that is heavily controversial. He's a divisive figure because the very basis for the conflict in Burundi now is the president's attempt to remain in office for a third term, even when his term in office had expired. The champion of third term in East Africa is President Museveni. He was the first leader to amend this country's constitution in 2005 to allow him to contest for a third term. So people viewed him as somebody who is not objective, and perhaps that's why the negotiations in the peace process in Burundi has not made much progress. But he's a natural choice. He's divisive. He has inspired Kagame to do a third term. He inspired the guy in Bujumbura, Nkurunziza, to do a third term. And he's now inspiring the DRC leader to do a third term as well. So he's a very divisive factor. My own view would be he's not the right person to have a proper mediation role in Burundi. And perhaps the African Union should have looked further afield for better negotiators. It seems we are doing so just to get money because the European Union promised us €3 million for that process. So it makes us some money as well. On the ICC, again, Maria is better placed to answer that. So, Maria, the difficult ones are left for you. Thank you very much.
Yeah, those are all difficult questions. On Burundi, I'll say, having lived there for several years, it's obviously been a tragic and terrible past year with the number of extrajudicial killings that have been going on. I agree with Nicholas that, you know, because of the history of Uganda's role in the Arusha Accords, there was a sort of natural sense that they should go back and look for President Museveni to be involved, though clearly the dynamics had changed given that this was about the third term. I also think very quickly last year it became apparent that both President Museveni and Honorable Kionga, the Minister of Defense, who was supposed to be the man on the scene for those talks, were both involved in their own campaigns for re-election and didn't really play the kind of assertive role, an active role that I think the AU and some Western powers wanted them to play. Honorable Kionga lost his election and President Museveni won his, and I think at this point there's hope that the Tanzanians will play the role that the Ugandans were supposed to play. So I get the sense anyway from the Americans and the British that there has been an acceptance that the Ugandans are, that the Ugandan government is not going to play the key role in Burundi. So we will see where those talks go and if there is progress now that Mpaka and others are going to play their part. When it comes to Kenya and the ICC, obviously it's been tragic. Human Rights Watch did a lot of work on documenting abuses during the post-electoral period. We actually just this year issued a report looking at the legacy of SGBV and the crimes, mostly rape, committed in that post-electoral period in late 2007 and early 2008, to look at the lack of accountability and even the, just the lack of social services and health and psychosocial support available to survivors of sexual violence from that period of time, to push the government not just on accountability but also on reparations, because there's been some discussion of access to reparations for certain groups, although there's not really much of a plan in place so far. On the question of witness tampering and the ICC, I think generally we would agree with you that obviously justice is very complicated, and we've had a lot of longstanding concerns about the way in which witnesses were treated in the whole process. You know, we have put out things to complain about that interference, and obviously the Thanksgiving service that took place over the weekend in Kenya was, you know, certainly it felt to us very, very troubling given the large number of victims who have had no justice in Kenya. So we continue to push for those, for some kind of accountability mechanism, and certainly hope that next year Kenya's elections will, you know, be able to take place without that kind of return to violence. But I think there's no doubt that Kenya still has a long way to go to recover from what occurred, and accountability may well slip through the cracks, unfortunately. Human Rights Watch will continue to talk about it. Obviously, many Kenyan groups will continue to talk about it. But whether we'll see traction, you know, I think it's very hard to say. I think I'll stop there. I mean, the role of the AU in the whole region is a very complicated question, and I think, you know, we continue to push the AU to improve its human rights mechanisms, but it's a challenge. I mean, the only sort of example we have where there's been a bit of progress was on this issue of, we put out a whole report looking at sexual exploitation and abuse of women in Somalia by AU soldiers, both mostly Ugandans but also Burundians. And in that case, the AU actually did agree to carry out their own investigation. They put out a set of recommendations. It's the first time that we've seen them do that on a human rights issue. So I think that was progress. At the same time, those recommendations haven't really been taken up yet. And we don't see the conduct and discipline unit of the African Union really being fully staffed and manned with the capacity to carry out much in the way of investigations when it comes to AU troops. That burden still ends up with the troop contributing countries themselves. And as we see there, accountability is really quite sporadic and not in a way in which Somali civilians can participate, and mostly doesn't occur at all. So the AU has a long way to go when it comes to sort of pushing for human rights protections among troop contributing countries around the region.
Thank you very much for the presentation. There is currently a case going on in one of the courts where a woman, a businesswoman, was tortured, and thereafter she died. A policeman, I think by the name of Baguma, has been indicted, and the courts have requested for his arrest and to be brought to court, but this has not happened. He has been promoted to some post in the town. So what do Ugandans have to do in such situations to realize justice? And then we have issues of land grabbing in some parts of the north, where companies through the government or police or the army coming to try and displace people in the name of industrialization. What avenues do these people have to go through to kind of protect their land and not get it displaced? Thank you.
Your hand was actually hidden.
Okay. I don't know if I can ask this. I just want to say thank you both so much for coming today. I've got a question for Nicholas. You've spoken tonight about people that have, I guess, stood up for basic human rights in Uganda and how they've been shamed, essentially, and on topic, essentially been intimidated and repressed. I'm wondering you yourself whether you faced any of these kind of situations, if I can ask that.
Yeah, sure.
Was there
one
of
the
best?
Yes.
Hi, Nicholas. My name is Alani. So I know that you've made, you mentioned about women and the corrupt, some members of corrupt government using harassment and sexual exploitation to disengage women in politically engaging in politics. So my question is that, and I know that Maria, you mentioned before that the AU is working really hard in terms of recommendation and reform and ensuring that women's rights are protected and they're not oppressed. So in terms of human rights perspective, like, what do you guys impose, come say 5 years' time, how do you then get the same women that were oppressed and sexually harassed during the politics to then getting the momentum of voting again and just voicing their opinion? Because I know that, you know, in some African countries, women are very marginalized and they're not very politically active. So what does the Ugandan government, what will they employ? I mean, these are people that have been tormented, and for them to come out of their shell again is going to be problematic.
Thank you.
Thank you for your questions. Let me just start with Isa. The case you're describing is familiar. I'm very familiar with it. This is a commandant of the force in the city center. He's alleged to have taken part in the murder of a businesswoman over a car deal gone bad. The director of public prosecutions has indicted him, has directed the police to arrest him, so that he's formally charged before a court of law. Unfortunately, those directives have been ignored. The same policeman is being deployed on the streets in Kampala every day to beat up people who are protesting. So the case is quite familiar. It's very frustrating, but it's an example of an ongoing trend of powerful people who are in the service of the state who can do anything and get away with it. The government spokesperson, his name is Ofondo Pondo, one time shot in broad daylight somebody who he accused to have snatched a bag from a woman, and he's still a government spokesperson. No charges against him. Recently, armed soldiers shot dead in full view of the camera a man in western Uganda who was just charging at them with a stick. The guy with the stick could have been foolish, but the punishment for somebody who is stupid and foolish is not execution. The common trend is that all of these cases go uninvestigated, people go unpunished. It's impunity. What can we do to ensure that these people are brought to book? In so many cases, we have never forgotten about their crimes. We take every opportunity to remind people that these are suspected criminals who should be in a court of law. So we do that really consistently in Uganda, on radio, on TV, on social media, everywhere we can. But in cases where we have the resources, take public interest litigation against them. There are so many of those cases, and there are just too few lawyers to have the courage and the interest to do these kind of cases. But in cases where we have an actual complainant who is willing to come forward and take the risk and give evidence, we have taken public interest cases to make sure that these kind of people are brought to book. About land grabbing, I come from northern Uganda. Northern Uganda is a very complicated part of the country, because in the 20 years of the war between the LRA and government of Uganda, the entire population was forced into camps. As a result, their land was left idle, and people who had access to state resources took land, took property, and claimed as their own. Now, when the war ended and people went back from camps to their villages, they only returned in many cases to find more powerful people claiming ownership of their ancestral land. And that has caused a big land problem, coupled with the land tenure system in northern Uganda, which is purely communal. People don't own titles. Land is owned communally, either for grazing, for farming, as a burial ground. So there's a serious land conflict in northern Uganda. But beyond northern Uganda, you have resource-based conflicts across the country in areas where you've discovered natural resources, say oil. The communities there are being deprived of their ancestral land. So land is becoming a very, very, very contentious issue in Uganda. If you go to court, you find many cases of assault, battery, hacking somebody with a panga. The cases might appear to you like an assault case, but in fact, the underlying reason for all those cases is a land conflict between families, between communities. So there's a serious land problem in Uganda. Now, there might be several things that can be done to ensure that we address the conflict. But I think in my view, a couple of things are urgent to be done. First is a reform of the land laws in Uganda, because you have multiple overlapping claims over land. You might have a land title in your hand, but somebody who has lived on your land for 15 years has a legal right called a bona fide occupant or called a lawful occupant, and you can do nothing about that person. You can't evict them. You must pay them to leave your own property. So we need to reflect on reforming the land tenure systems in Uganda to address some of these structural and legal problems. Sorry, I didn't get your name, my sister. You asked a personal question, whether I do not face threats. I do face threats, but I think they are just threats, okay? Somebody who is serious, who wants a fight, doesn't threaten you. They come and face you, fight. I face a lot of threats because of many of the kind of cases we take. They are very unpopular cases. I think the most difficult for me has been the 2014 challenge to Uganda's anti-gay law. At the time, I was serving as the Secretary General of the National Bar Association. I was fairly a powerful person within the law society. And you would imagine that lawyers are sophisticated. But, well, you'd be forgiven for imagining that, because lawyers within the law society mobilized to kick me out as the Secretary General of the Law Society, primarily because they thought that my challenge of the law was against, quote-unquote, the values of the law society. So we do face a lot of threats because of the kind of cases we take. I've gotten death threats on phone. My Facebook page is a good bouncing ground for lots of insults. Some people are really so dedicated. There's this one lady who, for the last 5 years, every week sends me 2 emails. I like her tenacity. Dedicated. She's called Regina Lule. Oh, I'm sorry. And her emails are nothing but just pages and pages of insults. No coherent sentence. Sorry, what am I doing wrong here? So she sends me pages and pages of words such as stupid, brain dead, agent of foreign powers, sodomite, a sellout, and that's like 10 paragraphs of those words. You just can't make sense of them. Just insult. She's dedicated. So we face those kind of threats. But as I said, the threats that I face are nowhere near the threats that the people that I serve face every day. Because I'm a fairly, popular guy in town, so I have many friends in high places. And I tell people that if you touch me, Maria will come after you. Maria is feared in Uganda. So I have friends in high places that, the cost of doing something to me is really very high. And so I survive, I'm fine. I leave the one on women to Maria. Again, not because you're a lady, but because it's a difficult question. So, thank you very much.
I guess I'll take that one.
Look, most countries have a long way to go when it comes to ensuring that women's rights are fully protected and that women of all socioeconomic levels can freely participate in politics. So There's, as I said, a long way to go. The AU has, you know, as I said, has made some steps to looking at this issue of sexual exploitation and abuse, but there is a long process ahead for it to really be leading the pack. The UN has the problems of these allegations of sexual exploitation and abuse going on in Central African Republic, so the UN is no model for the African Union. If anything, it's a model of what not to do in the face of these kinds of situations. And we certainly hope that the African Union would decide to actually lead the way and set up good models for accountability for sexual and gender-based crimes in conflict settings. I have to say, I think Uganda as a country has many very strong women leaders who have stood up to a lot of intimidation, repression, scrutiny. I mean, not only the woman who has been the Speaker of Parliament, who I don't always agree with, but she's been a strong political leader. Uganda has dedicated female parliamentarians who are supposed to be there to speak up for women's rights. Some of the opposition women leaders are certainly assertive and aggressive and have taken quite a beating. You know, I don't see women in Uganda, younger women in Uganda, pulling away from political life. If anything, the actions of the police in targeting women over the last year, my sense is at least, have emboldened a lot of younger women to step up and be more aggressive about demanding their rights. So we'll see where it goes, obviously, and it's certainly possible that we'll see some women choosing to self-censor. You know, we have those concerns certainly about the media, that as journalists are attacked in broad daylight, as we've seen journalists be arrested, that, you know, we are concerned that we see self-censorship among the journalists as far as choosing the stories that they decide to cover. That could certainly happen among younger women who, you know, may not decide to participate in political life. But thus far, that's not what I've seen. I mean, it would be interesting to hear from the Ugandans what they believe, but my sense is that there have been some very aggressive and assertive female politicians in Uganda. Whether one will ever hold presidency, we'll see. You know, many countries have a long way to go, including my own. So, thank you.
I'm afraid we do have to bring things to a close. I might finish off just by saying a few things about things that are coming up in the Caston Centre. The next event we've got scheduled is on the 22nd of May, an evening with Edward Snowden via video. Marius, where is that?
At the Melbourne Convention
At the Melbourne, yeah, it's in conjunction with Think Inc., and so that is a paid event. It's not a free event, but that's on the 22nd of May. And then we have our annual conference on the 22nd of July, and we've started to unveil the list of speakers if you look at our website or if you receive our emails. I should also mention that yesterday we launched our annual appeal. Our aim is once again to use our academic expertise and our reputation to improve human rights protection and to support the human rights leaders of tomorrow, and also to educate the public. And so tonight's event is part of that program of public education, and we have for many years been, you know, delighted to provide most of these events for free, apart from the two that I just mentioned, but such as the one tonight. And so we're very grateful to our current donors, and if you would feel like joining them, there is a donation box outside. Is that right, Janice? And also there's a form on each of the seats. Look, thank you all for coming tonight, and I also have to thank Human Rights Watch for bringing our speakers and for offering the Caston Centre the opportunity to co-host. And will you please also join me in thanking Maria Burnett and Nicholas Apio for their excellent speeches tonight.